This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 9th of June 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 139th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Beware the fetish for a theme, folks, for today we're going to perfect the art of throwing mud at a wall and seeing what sticks, but with some lovingly made sods of cultural turf. We'll welcome the wonderful and brilliantly named The's prime creative force, Matt Johnson, into the studio to talk about his seminal album Soul Mining, 30 years after it first dropped.
I was worried that I might hate it. I thought it sounded really fresh, full of vitality and urgency. There's certain lyrical sections that I sort of wince a bit because I was a kid, I was in my teens.
We head to Berlin to see if the city in which everyone seems to be an artist can actually display the stuff as we investigate the 8th edition of the Berlin Biennale.
For me, it's about slightly reorienting our cartographic imagination and historical imagination of the city and see where this part of town fits.
And we'll visit the British festival based not around sex, drugs and rock and roll, or even novelists in marquees, but philosophy.
Philosophy is about what it's about to be alive, for goodness sake. And surely that isn't, you know, arcane at all. Surely it's something that is absolutely central to all of us.
Plus, we'll meet the Ivorian comedians behind a political satire radio show making waves in Abidjan. We'll speak to author Tom Rachman about his new book, The Rise and Fall of Great Powers. And we'll enjoy a Midori House session from British folk singer Katie Brooks. Hold on tight, because that's all to come right here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. So here we go, item one. A song. Katie Brooks is a British folk singer who grew up between London, Bristol and Arizona. Now based back in the UK, she's just released her second EP named I Fought Lovers. Her rich vocals have been compared to those of Annie Lennox, and she's even been called a female John Martin. I think she sounds a little bit like Beth Gibbons. On the new record, she's combined her folky background with a touch of soul to create a bold yet moody collection of songs. We invited her in to perform for us here at Midori House. And first, here she is with I Fought Lovers.
Well, I saw your lover in the forest. I saw your lover in a moment, and you were mine. I saw your light in the cold woods. I saw your eyes in the cold light of day, and you were mine the moment I laid eyes. And you were mine the moment I. See. face in mine again. Ah, 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 ah.
That was Katie Brooks with I Fought Lovers from the EP of the same name. And stick around, because you know how the show works. There'll be more from her and a chat later on in the show. You're listening to Culture right here on Monocle 24, where we're rather honoured to welcome Matt Johnson, the man behind one of the 1980s and 90s most imaginative and tricksily titled bands, The The. Of course, there are endless pages of discourse on the subject, as with any fan's band, but many believe the group's magnum opus to be 1983's Soul Mining. 30 years later, that album is set to be re-released and given the luxury treatment of heavyweight vinyl, gatefold sleeve, essays, artwork, the lot. It's all very nice, but really it's the record itself, a dark yet sort of funky mix of new wave rock and pop with some very literate lyrics that speaks volumes. That and the man himself, Matt Johnson.
Why I didn't wake up this morning, 'cause you didn't go to bed. You were watching the whites of your eyes turn red. The calendar on your wall is ticking. The days off, you've been reading some old letters. You smile and think how much you've changed. All the money in the world couldn't buy back those days. You pull back your head and the sun burns into your eyes. You watch your plane.
That record, Soul Mining, is difficult to put into a slot. You know how music writers love to put things into slots? Yeah. Maybe the fans do too. Does it matter to you?
I'm glad.
Whether it's got a pigeonhole.
I'm glad it's not got a pigeonhole. I've tried never to have a pigeonhole my entire life. So each album that I did was quite different from the preceding one. Funny thing, actually, around about the time of Soul Mining, just as I think I was about to, or was during the making of Soul Mining, I got to meet Leonard Cohen, who was one of the people that I really admired from CBS, because we shared the same lawyer, a chap called Marty Machat, who was Leonard's manager and lawyer, but also represented Phil Spector as well. He was quite a legendary character.
Yeah.
And he wanted me to introduce me to Leonard so that Leonard could give me some words of advice, really. And as I was just a 21-year-old kid, very eager to learn. And he shared various things with me, but one of the things that he did say to me, he warned me about, he said, music journalists are very, very lazy. And he said, you've got to be very, very careful. He said, because they will try to force you into a little box, and once you're in that box, you can never get out of it again. And he said, look at me. He said, whenever the name Leonard Cohen is mentioned in any article, the words gloomy, depressing always come up. And he was the most charming, funny guy. And the same things ended up happening to me. People, you know, the amount of press I got where it was depressing or it was gloomy, which was no reflection on who I was as a person. It's just because I chose to write about quite serious subject matter, quite political stuff, sexual stuff, the sort of subject matter that wouldn't normally be expressed in popular music.
It was more the sort of it seems like your preoccupations were those that might have been dealt with in painting or certainly literature, but not in pop music. But the music itself maybe didn't bear that out.
I just felt that, you know, why shouldn't you? This is life. You know, life does involve love, death, war. You know, we're all subject to these laws of the world that we inhabit. And a big influence on me as a songwriter was John Lennon. You know, probably the biggest influence. And John Lennon famously said, just tell the truth and make it rhyme, you know, and that truth can be whatever, you know. And I go through life, I'm on a personal level, I could be interesting about what's happening in Syria or the Ukraine or whatever, or the next minute there's some other thought that's non-political, there's sort of sexual thoughts. That's what human nature is about, you know, all these incredible aspects of life that pass through us. And the idea of being told by whoever, well, you can't, this is inappropriate subject matter for songwriting. I just thought this was an absolute load of nonsense. So that would probably mean why the stuff is hard to categorise, because it doesn't really sound like anyone else, because maybe other people do play by different rules to me, I don't know. I'm just a symptom of the moral.
Interviews around the world, maybe from Japan to the US to back in the UK and in Europe, that people go, wow, I love Dusk. It was nothing like Soul Mining. Whereas in Britain, the UK, the music press might go, well, what, why have you done this?
Yeah, there was a lot
I'm unfamiliar
of that.
With this.
Yeah, there's a lot of that over here. It used to drive me nuts. And even now, I'm just doing it, releasing a lot of soundtrack work at the moment. That's the particular phase that I'm in. But I continually get pestered and hounded by, well, when are you going to do a new album, a proper album, like with vocals on it? But the same people that moan the loudest that I've not done a new album are also the same people that moan the loudest when I do an album, because it's like, well, it doesn't sound like the last one. So you can't, you just got to put it out of your mind. You can't worry about that. But talking about the other cultures, particularly Japan, I've only been to Japan once many years ago and I haven't had the chance to go back. But I noticed, I think it's become more Americanized, unfortunately, because the cultural differences were quite shocking in a good way. For instance, one of my strongest memories, we did played a concert. It was a large venue, it was a sold out show, and we were on stage, played the songs, and instead of there being applause, it was silent. And Johnny Marr, who was my guitarist at the time, sidled up to me and he whispered in my ear, he said, the only thing that could make this gig any weirder is if we had no clothes on.
So there it is.
And the weird thing was, when it was so surreal, but when people stood up, people started to stand up, there were these men at the side of the stage with these very, very long sticks. They were about 30 feet long, these sticks, with soft foam round balls on the end, and they would tap people on the head until they sat down. I thought, this whole thing is so surreal.
Sounds like a ritual.
It was really bizarre. But I loved it because it was so different. Once I got used to the fact that
it's about respect,
exactly.
Isn't it?
And once I got used to that, oh, okay, this means they really like it. Then I thoroughly enjoyed it, but it was so so surreal.
I wanted finally to bring it back to the record, Matt, back to Soul Mining. And I guess it's one of those albums that leaps out of the speakers. I know you're obviously, like most artists, you're always thinking the next thing, not the thing you did before, and certainly not the thing you did 30 years ago. But I know you've remastered this at Abbey Road.
Yeah.
You've obviously spent a lot of time up close and personal with something that you made 30 years ago. Mm. What is that like? Can you listen to it as if you're just a listener, or are you always the maker of those songs? Can you listen to it and go, God, this is pretty good?
Well, it's an interesting question, because I don't have copies of my own records at home. I just, you know, I think they're down at my dad's probably, but I just don't really listen to my own stuff. So when the idea for this came about, I intentionally didn't go and retrieve a copy. I thought, okay, I'm going to keep my head clear of the recording. Went into Abbey Road, we baked the tapes, because as you probably know, there's a process with old analog tape. You have to bake it at low temperature overnight to dry it out, because otherwise the oxide comes off. So we baked the tapes, ran it for the first time, checked the test tones, and it lined up very, very well. So I was pleased about that. Then when I listened to it the first time, this was the first time in years I'd heard it, I did think it sounded great, actually. I was very impressed, because I was worried that I might hate it. I thought it sounded really fresh, full of vitality and urgency. There's certain lyrical sections that I sort of wince a bit, because I was a kid. I was in my teens. I was 19, 20, 21 when I wrote it and recorded it. So I was very young. We decided to not put any compression on it. We ran it through the old TG Series EMI mastering desk, which is from the 1970s. So it's very, very pure sounding. In fact, it sounds very, very, probably closer to how it sounded when we mixed it than even the first time it came out on vinyl, because the first time it came out on vinyl, we may have, you know, tweaked it more and messed around with it and compressed it. So this is really, really as close as you would get to the original master tapes when we mixed it in 1983.
That was There's Matt Johnson. You can get your hands on the remastered repack deluxe edition of Soul Mining on the 30th of June. those just joining us, you're tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. The 8th edition of the Berlin Biennale kicked off on May the 28th. The last event saw Polish artist-curator Arthur Zmijewski inviting the Occupy movement to squat a contemporary arts centre and staging other political actions which alienated art critics and confused viewers. This iteration, curated by Canadian-Colombian curator Juan A. Gaitan, is less overtly political and far more global. But does the global approach pack enough punch to make an artistic statement? Monocle's Berlin correspondent Kimberly Bradley reports.
Mexican artist Carlos Amorales, whose video work soundtrack we hear, is one example of the non-European artist taking part in the 8th edition of the Berlin Biennale. As well as moving the range of exhibitors out of Europe, Juan A. Gaitan has physically taken the show out of Berlin's artsy center. He's placed his Biennale in the Ethnological Museums in the far western residential district of Dahlem, the Haus am Waldsee Villa in nearby Zehlendorf, and Kunstwerke, the event's traditional anchor in Berlin Mitte. But why?
The three venues are the KW, which is the epicenter of the Biennale anyway, and I wanted to keep it because it's a center dedicated to contemporary art, and I think we need to protect the autonomy of these spaces instead of work against them at this point in history. And the museums in Dahlem was a good dispositif for sparking a discussion about what the museum is today, what are its functions and what should its functions be. And the Haus am Waldsee is sort of the antithesis of a biennial venue, and I liked to play with that aspect of it.
Gaitan's concept explores German colonialism. These ethnographic collections will ultimately be relocated to Berlin's city castle and multicultural center, now under construction. He also wanted to at last move Berlin's Biennale beyond its longtime fixation on post-war trendiness and politics.
For me, it's about slightly reorienting our cartographic imagination and historical imagination of the city and see where this part of town fits.
In Dahlem, biennial goers move through airy exhibition spaces alternating contemporary art with artifacts from places like South America and Asia. Nothing is spelled out. Viewers come up with their own conclusions. Of 53 artists, less than a handful are German. Many come from South America, like multimedia artist Mario Garcia Torres, who incorporates sound into his work. Guadeloupe-born artist Jimmy Robert exhibits a two-channel video of a drag queen dancing near a Brazilian Oscar Niemeyer building as a voice narrates a poem in Portuguese.
Olho, muito tempo, o corpo de poema.
Sicilian artist Rosa Barba's feature-length film, shown in a vast room on a retro film projector, juxtaposes nature with man-made decay. Besides video art, many works on paper hang in rows, which is often quietly narrative and poetically political.
The part that I am interested in is when the individual is at the heart of this discourse on politics and not only the kind of common sense of society or community politics. So many of these seem more poetical because there is a much more empirical and personal relationship to politics and history in the works.
One work was personal and public. Athens-based architect-artist Andreas Angelidakis filled a front room at Kunstwerke with 100 antique handmade Greek carpets he found in Athens flea markets. Walls, floors, and multiple levels to sit on and linger in. Called Crash Pad, it's an immediate meeting point, as well as a metaphor for Greek-German relations.
I mean, this space is a kind of political statement for the history of Greece. It comes out of this complex history of how Greece negotiated its position in Europe ever since it became liberated from the Ottoman Empire. And this is a mix, you know, there's a few ancient Greek columns and then folklore carpets. And the idea was to take these opposed factions or things or ways of doing stuff and make something comfortable out of them. So like a welcoming space.
Issues of post-colonialism, migration, labor and oppression echo throughout the entire exhibition. But one artist goes way out. At Kunstwerke, Mexican artist Julieta Aranda's video, a critic's favorite, speculates what space colonies might be like.
Well, the work is a lot of questioning notions of escape and freedom. I was very generously again invited to do a zero gravity flight as an artist a couple of years ago. And what I knew I wanted to do there was to record my heartbeat and to do some video, which I did. And then I sat on that work. That was not even work. I sat on that material for quite a while, trying to put it together with my own curiosities, with my own train of thought I have been following, the kind of inquiry, I guess, if you want to call it. And it slowly started putting itself together.
Aranda even gave a concert opening weekend with music based on data from the flight. For all its interesting art, the 8th Berlin Biennale has already been criticized for being too disparate, too cautious, too didactic. The last Biennale, curated by Polish artist Artur Ziemiewski, took risks but was universally panned, in part for inviting the Occupy movement to live in the Biennale's main venue, Kunstwerke. Did Gaetan have Berlin Biennale 7 in mind while curating number 8?
I mean, whenever it wasn't in my mind, it was brought up. And one of the advantages of the Berlin Biennale is that it can be a different thing in each of its editions. So this one is clearly different, but that's only because I have a different approach to art than Artur has.
Gaetan's global exhibition finally shook Berlin out of its Berlinness, and he might be remembered as turning a new page in the event. Is this representative of the larger art world? Andreas Angelidakis explains.
Berlin, even though it's like a very much an institution, the Berlin Biennale, I still feel it has a vibe of a young biennale somehow. So I think it's a pretty precise description of what the art world is becoming. You know, it's not about those like centers of for art as it used to be. Like, it's not about New York anymore, and it's not about specifically London. That's where the art fairs happen for sure, but the art world is much more expanded than that. And so even peripheral places like Greece or India or the Philippines could be part of that art world. So I think that's a natural reaction. Of course, obviously here it also relates to Juan Gaitán, the curator, his take for this edition, which is a lot about global politics and how the world came to be the way it is or where is it going. So it's a reflection of that, but it's also a natural progression of the art world.
As the world comes to it, Berlin is finally looking outward too.
There's just so many biennials you can make about the same city, yeah? That's a little bit navel-gazing. So I think it's important to, especially at the time when Berlin is very inhabited by people that come from elsewhere, it's kind of nice to show that elsewhere, so.
And for a final take on the elsewhere, a luscious intercultural art star soundbite. Paris-based Albanian artist Henri Salla's Unravel, which art hounds might recognize, is a remix of his Venice Biennial contribution last year, now here. Breathtaking, as always. For Monocle, in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
Thanks, Kim. The Berlin Biennale runs until August the 8th, so plenty of time to get down there and make up your own mind about this summer's event. After the break, we get philosophical at the How the Light Gets In festival, plus more from Katie Brooks's Midori House session. Stay right where you are.
The Globalist provides insight and analysis of the key news and business stories in Europe and the Middle East. Informed, engaging and authoritative, it's a 60-minute bulletin of news, features and opinion. Two presenters in London are joined by guests in our studio and all around the world, including Monocle's editors and friends in our Hong Kong and Tokyo bureau. The Globalist also features an extended daily newspaper review with a special guest here in Midori House. And of course, we round up the business headlines with an expert analyst in a key city. All that and more every weekday at 6 a.m. London time on The Globalist.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now to the town of Hay-on-Wye and the beautiful borders of England and Wales, where bookish types descend each year for the Hay Literature Festival. At least that was the case until a new festival popped up 5 years ago, shamelessly piggybacking the footfall of the more established Hay Festival. The How the Light Gets In Fest provides a different appeal to the punters, namely philosophy and music, baby. Monocle's Alid John joined the younger crowd to review this year's offering.
In the hills of the Welsh borders, Hay-on-Wye now plays host to two festivals over the May period. You have the well-established and quite staid Hay Literature Festival, and you have the rather rowdy How the Light Gets In, a mixture of armchair philosophy, politicians past and present, peddling books and their wisdom for a pound or two, and nicely picked musical acts to keep things busy until gone two in the morning. It's a rather obscure mix, but one that ultimately works, despite the terrible weather, at times haphazard organisation, and guests going AWOL. There aren't many festivals where you can walk through the small yard next to the main Globe venue and talk shop with Norman Lamont over a whiskey, to then pop over to see Mr. Scruff DJ until 1 a.m. The director of the Institute for Art and Ideas and the founder of the festival, Hilary Lawson, himself a philosopher, tells me the reasoning behind it.
Philosophy is about what it's about to be alive, for goodness sake. And surely that isn't, you know, arcane at all. Surely it's something that is absolutely central to all of us. And so it was that thought that in our culture, we've forgotten that. And in fact, we're slightly embarrassed by it. You know, philosophy is just a bit airy-fairy nonsense, really. Let's just keep it sort of straightforward. And I just think, well, there's something wrong about this. You know, we ought to feel comfortable about talking about the things about what life's about. So the festival is trying to put big ideas back into British culture.
One of the debates that drew much attention was the panel discussion on Edward Snowden's whistleblowing and the idea of an open society. It didn't so much sharpen that philosophical edge as, well, bring three wise men not directly involved with the issue to talk to a crowd of like-minded, predominantly liberal types enjoying the delights of the Welsh town thus far. To be fair, David Ormond was the former head of GCHQ from 96 to 97 and did bring some clarity to the discussion. But I'm not entirely sure what former Energy Secretary Chris Huhne was doing with the microphone. Here's the man himself.
I have been on a diverse array of things. I was booked essentially to do a session on the Ed Snowden issue and whistleblowers and the morality of how you hold often secretive institutions to account. I was also doing something on tax avoidance. And then I was booked in to do a solo session on climate change. So I did a session on climate change.
Let's look at the first one, if we can, Open Society and Its Enemies. What did you draw from that? I know you were on the panel with David Ormond, John Norton. Anything actually learnt from that, or was it just a fairly pleasant experience talking about stuff which is quite interesting to an extent?
I think that the positions on this are now fairly well entrenched, and Sir David Ormond, as a former head of GCHQ, is clearly going to argue in one direction, and I wrote a fairly long piece in Prospect some months ago about why I thought Edward Snowden was right to blow the whistle on what was happening in the NSA and GCHQ, and I still think that it reveals a massive failure of democratic accountability, and I still think that the behaviour of the intelligence community at the time leaves a lot of unanswered questions. So I think that there are still big issues to be resolved politically here, but I think the facts of the matter are pretty clear. And I only wish that we had a rather more robust debate about the lack of democratic accountability here by comparison with what has been going on in the United States.
The irony of a robust debate lost, perhaps. It's telling that Huhne won the crowd over, while Lamond was left rather deflated by the constant opposition from those attending. But the atmosphere, despite the wet weather, is positive. From green issues, urbanism, politics, the role of the state, some scant philosophy and more, there's a lot on offer. Many attending are pleased to hear someone who was once important contribute to something that they may or may not really have a view on. Hilary Lawson again.
Our understanding of philosophy is not that somehow this is this narrow bit which is called philosophy, which is, I don't know, about logic and language. Seems to me absurd. Philosophy is what we were talking about to start with. It's about the big issues in life, all of the big issues in life.
Just finally, are you surprised at how well it's going? I know the numbers have grown from 1,500 to 2,000 the year that I went, which was 4 years ago, I think, to 25,000, 30,000, 40,000 odd.
Yeah, of course. Well, of course, I'm amazed in a way. It's completely extraordinary how it's grown. But I think it's a function of many things. It's partly a function of the fact that the debates aren't happening somewhere else. As we encourage, again, people said to me to start, how are you going to get people to put these ideas in ways that are going to be accessible to the public? And it then turned out that the debates that were most interesting people, the ones that appeared to be the most technical, then we realised, actually, it's not about trying to make things accessible to the public. It's just about talking to each other. And I think as a result of that, it's really exciting to be in. It's exciting for the speakers because they have this space and they don't really have it anywhere else. I mean, our politicians who come here, I think, often say, why do so many politicians come here? And I think it's because politicians actually are interested in politics. So they want to talk to other people about the big issues that drove them in the first place of why they're engaged in it. And so I think that's why it then becomes exciting for everybody else, why they get taken along with it.
Whether you believe that or not, the variety on offer across the town provides something for most. And if, like some, your spirits are left dampened by the discussions, the evening's live music acts offer some light relief into the early hours. For Monocle, in Hay on Wye, I'm Alad John.
Thank you, Alad, and I assure you that black polo necks and horn rim spectacles come as standard. Still to come in part two, more of that Midori House session, plus a bit of chat with Katie Brooks. We head to the Ivory Coast to meet the radio presenters keeping the country's sense of humour in check, and we find out about the latest release from author Tom Rachman. Keep those headphones glued to your skull and your seatbelt firmly fastened as we zoom into the second half of Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Time for a bit more music now from Amadori House sessionista Katie Brooks. She'll be chatting to Monocle's Paul Noble in just a minute, but before that, let's have another track. Here she is with State of Mind.
Winter comes and winter goes, will you be the dark that stays? Fallen trees have buried my skin, but I've learned to love this way. Who are you calling when you call my name? Are you asking for me when you call? Well, baby, I'll be the one that you need if you ask me to stay for the fall. I wanna wrap my body around you. I'm so glad I found you. I'm so glad I found you in this state of mind. And the roads that wind you won't be the earth that binds you. Won't be the earth that binds you in this state of mind. Hello, do you see the light in my eyes? I've seen heaven, hell in yours, and baby, I wanna give. Hold on to the calling of the dawn of time. Lend my hand to the devil inside, so maybe I can call you mine.
Katie Brooks, thank you very much for that magical session.
Thank you.
Just you and a guitar.
Yes.
So let's start first of all with the very distinctive aroma in this room, which was your... you've cracked the secret of how to do vocal warm-ups.
Yeah.
Can you share that with all your other
musicians?
I didn't
realise you were going to out me on the radio. Yeah, it is a wee dram of whiskey.
Okay.
Which is... that is my secret. Before I do any singing at all, I always have a little dram because I've tried lots of things.
I've done the honey and lemon.
I've done honey and lemon. I've done not speaking for the day leading up to singing. Doesn't work.
That's called the saline.
That is called the saline, yeah. But this does actually work.
Okay. Well, I mean, we heard the results. It certainly works. Let's go back a few steps. You grew up in a very musical setting, is that right?
Yeah, I did in many ways. I mean, if you're sort of referring to things that are written in my biography about growing up in a kind of commune setting.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was interesting. That was different, not your sort of 2.4 general setup.
But and where was this?
Well, we sort of travelled in a sort of random triangle between Bristol, London and Arizona, which is not a triangle you'd normally...
time-honoured route.
Yeah, you'd not normally put that together. But yeah, that's where we went. So I spent quite a lot of time in Arizona as a kid. And there was a lot of music in my life. And my dad was also a singer-songwriter. So yeah, it's definitely wasn't unfamiliar to me.
And you're recording at the moment... in a church,
yeah,
I've read. And is that the whole band or is that just you and your guitar? How's that working?
It's just me and the guitar, and then the band comes into a studio, because as beautiful as that space is, it's not good for like bass guitar.
No.
And drums. It would be pretty wishy-washy, but for my vocals it's perfect. The natural reverb is just incredible, which is why I chose that space to do. And I can't really imagine recording my vocals anywhere else now.
Let's talk for a moment about your voice, because it's a very instantly arresting voice, as everyone who's now heard your session can see. Do people sort of make comparisons when they hear you sing?
Yeah, it goes everywhere with the comparisons, because it really depends on the song. And I've tried to be one voice, but it's just not who I am. It's like my genre. We've never quite been able to totally pin me down, because I go with what I feel. I used to have Tracy Chapman quite a lot, and June Tabor and Joan Armatrading and Annie Lennox. That's for the sort of deep stuff. And then I get Hannah Reid now, obviously, because of London Grammar coming out. And then I get female John Martin, which I quite like.
That's good.
Yeah, I really like that.
That's one. That's a nice comparison to have.
Yeah, so there's quite a few.
That was Katie Brooks speaking to Paul Noble. Her EP, I Fought Lovers, is out now, and she's playing dates across the UK this summer. Find out more at katiebrooks.com. That's Katie with an E-Y, and you're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bound. In 2006, London-born journalist Tom Rackman was living in Paris, working for the International Herald Tribune newspaper. Having spent years at the Associated Press with assignments in New York, Rome, and as far afield as Sri Lanka, Rackman came to Paris with literary ambitions. It was here in his free time that he borrowed from his expat experience, added a fictional world, and furiously wrote what would become one of the most sensational debut novels in recent years, called The Imperfectionists. The often hilarious, sometimes sad, and always entertaining story of an English language newspaper in Rome, The Imperfectionists was an immediate critical and commercial success, and it went on to be published in 25 languages. Now, just this month, his second novel has finally arrived. It's called The Rise and Fall of Great Powers. Right before hopping on a plane to start a month-long North American book tour, Tom swung by Midori House to speak with Monocle's Daniel Giacopelli.
The Rise and Fall of Great Powers is a novel, and it's really a book about a bookseller. Her name is Tuli Zilberberg, and she owns this dusty little store in the wild Welsh countryside, where she's surrounded by millions and millions of pages, but almost no customers whatsoever. She doesn't particularly mind that, though, because when people come in, they ask her questions, they ask her about her life, and that's something she's not altogether comfortable talking about. She had a sort of strange past in her as a child. She lived all around the world, moved from one country to another, was whisked around by a group of three peculiar adults. And then, quite suddenly, they all disappeared from her life. And in the years since, she's never understood what happened and why. And quite suddenly, at this bookshop, she receives a message one day, and it's from somebody who knew her back in the old days. And she finds herself prompted. This is a woman who spent her whole life reading about stories. She suddenly finds herself piecing together the story of her own life. And the way that the book is structured is that the story moves around as you read through it. It leaps between the 1980s, around the year 2000, and the present day, and jumps around, juxtaposes those three periods. So from the end of the Cold War through the dominance of U.S. power and the wobbles that followed, and then the digital revolution of today. And it's a story, then, a book that is about one life, but it's also a book about the times.
It's a book that's focused on books in some sense. The Imperfectionist was focused on newspapers. I mean, you must love print.
Yeah, it's true. I can't deny that I do love print. I love books, and I don't have anything against ebooks necessarily either. But I think that, you know, with the Imperfectionist, it was set in this struggling newspaper, and this new book, it begins at a struggling bookshop. And so it's easy to think, well, the first one was in a way chronicling the decline and collapse of the traditional news media. So is this something about the decline and perhaps struggles of the publishing industry? And it's not really. I think that I am very interested, however, in the ways that our culture and our machines collide in living today. And I think, though, that in writing about this, in thinking about books and the place that they hold in people's lives, I came to believe that books have an advantage over newspapers, for example. Newspapers are timely and they're disposable, and books aspire to longevity, and books aspire to offer something that perhaps is a counterpoint to the disjunctive, fragmented, distracted world that we all live in and enjoy in various ways, but nonetheless sometimes struggle to really focus. And I think that books offer a point to pause all of the chaos and sink into something at a much deeper level. And perhaps for that reason, they're threatened, but perhaps also that's their strength.
And you're heading to the States soon for a book tour. Do you find that the books that you've written, The Imperfectionist, Elise, and your new one, have resonated with Americans in any way? I mean, more so than anywhere else? I mean, because Americans love their tales of expats and foreign lands, and both of your books feature people who were used to live in America and are now overseas.
Yeah, I can't say yet how this new book resonates or doesn't resonate with people, hopefully the former. But with The Imperfectionists, one of the great things about the book, one of the things that surprised me was that people didn't respond to it similarly around the world, but there were sort of echoes in different countries, different places where you would imagine that maybe people would be reading totally differently. But actually, I was struck more by common community of readers, all of these people who are connected to books and love them as I do and never know each other and will never meet and maybe don't even have a common language, but nonetheless, they share this involvement with words, and those are my people.
And finally, are you happy the life of the novelist? Do you ever yearn for the going out and reporting? And I know you still write for newspapers, but do you yearn for the journalist life?
Well, I think I'm pretty happy with writing my own sort of thing most of the time. I do like the idea and still enjoy, as you said, occasionally freelancing for magazines and newspapers and stuff like that, because I feel that, firstly, a writer's life is quite solitary, and there's the risk that you just spend your life in your room forever, and I like to interact with other people. But I also, secondarily, think that it has a value for the writing in the long term, because you risk otherwise having the resources only of the experiences you've lived up to the point at which you started writing full time. Whereas if you keep going out and doing other things, as I hope to do for the rest of my life, then you get to see other people, absorb other experiences, and your fiction in the future is all the richer for it, I hope.
That was author Tom Rackman speaking to Monocle's Daniel Jacopelli in his new book, The Rise and Fall of Great Powers. It's available now in the UK and in the US from the 10th of June. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. After the break, a quick trip to the Ivory Coast for a bit of political satire. You know how it is. Stay right where you are.
It's a green thumbs up from us for Tokyo's leading flower market and auction, where merchants indulge in the business of buying blooms.
The Japanese flower market is the place for perfectionists. Anyone looking for a branch of cherry blossom just before it flowers, or a blemish-free orchid with every flower facing the same way.
Blooms or Bust, a photographic essay on the Ota flower market, now showing in the film section on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds. Politicians have always been a pretty easy target for comedians. Here in Britain throughout the 80s and 90s, we had political satire TV show Spitting Image, where characters were all played by puppets. Running on a similar format is France's Les Guignols de l'Info and Kenya's XYZ show. But what happens when you take away these larger-than-life caricatures and just focus on the voices? Laughter Work is a daily radio show based in the Ivory Coast capital, Abidjan. Multiple presenters spend 2 hours impersonating some of the country's most famous political names, and the programme's taken the nation by storm. Some may think that a show like this might be a bit risky in a place that's suffered with political crises and civil war in recent years, but perhaps it's just what the doctor ordered. After all, laughter is the best medicine. Bram Posthumus has this story from Abidjan.
Slick boulevards, six-lane motorways to every corner of this 7 million metropolis, and smack in the middle of it all is Le Plateau, home to business, banks, government, parliament, and Abidjan's premier commercial radio station. Pop tunes, adverts, meet and greet shows, and for the last 18 months, Radio Nostalgie has hit the ratings jackpot with this.
After work, y'a pour tous les goûts.
Live from Monday to Friday, Laughter Work is a bit of light relief for Ivorians. Here's producer and presenter Jean-Jacques Vault.
Le programme After Work est un peu...
Laughter Work is the programme that makes light fun of African presidents. In the Ivory Coast, for instance, we've been at the receiving end of whatever our presidents have been throwing at us. So when we came out of the civil war 3 years ago, we thought that just this once, we'd muck around with those presidents, like they'd done with us. And in the process, we'd make everybody laugh.
And it sounds like this. So that's the idea. Connie is Radio Nostalgie's station manager. She explains how the show got on air in the first place.
There was a show that had come to the end of its natural life, so we had an empty slot. We wanted to try something entirely new and hit upon the idea of a radio comedy show. Luckily, we already had one of the country's best comedians visiting our studio, so we created a show around him and our producer.
And why should a comedy show be welcomed with such open arms here? Well, Ivorians have humor in their DNA, as Jean-Jacques Varold explains. They've had a 10-year political crisis thrown at them. They lived through civil war. Abidjan was a battlefield in early 2011. And they still live with poverty and joblessness. Humor has been their saving grace. You go to the Maquis, the open-air restaurant and drinking spot, and an Ivorian national institution, you grab a few beers, and you laugh it off. Oh, and the other reason? The sheer amount of talent on the show. Here's the captain, the man in the driver's seat and around whom the show has been constructed.
I'm Yo Patrick, working under the name of Chukun Pat. I'm an entertainer for the social and culture services of the armed forces of Ivory Coast, also named best comedian of the country in 2012 and 2013. I work for live audiences and on radio and television.
Chukun Pat is a veteran of the Ivorian state with 20 years in the business, and it's his political impressions that really bring this show to life. Here he is imitating Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara.
Je voudrais aussi vous remercier de votre présence aujourd'hui.
Nous avons dit,
je vous remercie
pour le parti, il fallait voir le cheval gagnant.
But he's not alone in the studio.
Je ne réponds jamais aux invectives de personne.
Tous les après-midi, avec les auditeurs que j'apprécie et qu'ils m'aiment.
The Laughter Work lineup is completed by two other characters. Tonton Jo, who actually works for the National Electricity Utility, and the young, multi-talented fellow who is currently having a huge hit with this tune.
My name is Zimbale Suleimani, but my artist name is Mala Adamo. I am a storyteller, but I also imitate a few heads of states from neighboring countries. You need to follow them closely. You need to get to know their tics. Take the president of Burkina Faso, for instance. The man speaks perfect French, but has a heavy accent. Once you got that right, you play around with it.
Put these four in a studio, open up the mics, and let rip. They imitate the subjects, launch deadpan one-liners, and create an air of pleasant derangement. Add to this live phone-ins and you've got a winner. Advertisers are lining up around the block to be involved with the show. Laughter Work is unstoppable, says station manager Connie.
These are still edgy times, but you can use humour to say some home truths. This programme knows no censorship. The comedians go wherever they please. But yes, we do have a central message that we are trying to get across with this show, a message of peace. We have moved into a new era as a nation, and we need to look ahead together.
Laughter Work is a sign that times have really changed here. After all, the First Lady herself is one of the station's owners. And the rumours are that the current inhabitants of the presidential palace are big fans. For Monocle, in Abidjan, I'm Bram Posthumus.
Thanks, Bram. And that brings us to the end of this week's show. Next week, I'll be speaking to French film director Jean-Pierre Jeunet about his new release, The Young and Prodigious T.S. Spivet. And we'll have Hot Chips' Alexis Taylor in to play us some delights from his new solo record. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Holly Fisher, which means there's nobody to talk nonsense about. Congratulations, Holly, and welcome on board. But next week, you won't get off the hook so easily. This is the honeymoon period in every sense. Time for one final track this week from Katie Brooks' wonderful Midori House session. Here she is with In Light of You. Thanks, as ever, for tuning in.
Oh, our love is true, even when it's almost through. And our minds, they change. What once was wise may now seem strange. But I will bathe in the light of your glow. Yes, I will bathe in the light of your glow. And the sinking of your eyes will never know just how much I loved you. How I am rich with memories of your lovingness. And I, how times ago, falling that I'd never show. So I will bathe in the light of your glow. Yes, I will bathe in the light of your glow. And the sinking of your eyes will never know just how much I loved you so. Just how much I love you so. I will bathe in the light of your glow. I will bathe in the light of your soul. I will bathe in the light of your glow. I will bathe in the light of your soul. Just about